Hi, welcome to Big Ideas, a show where I bring to you big ideas from some of the world's best thinkers across a range of topics, right from AI to mental health, science to philosophy. Today, my guest is Shane Parrish. Shane is widely known for creating Burnham Street, a blog, a podcast, learning community. He's also the author of several books, and the latest one is Clear Thinking. You should definitely check it out. In this conversation, we explore various aspects of mental models, how do we apply them to parenting and everything in between. We start with Shane's startup journey and what are some of the challenges that he has faced while building Burnham Street?
It was really hard. I mean, I left working for a three-letter intelligence agency about 2016. And I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I just know that I didn't want to do that anymore. And, you know, there's that story. I think it's Steve Jobs who basically said, you know, if there's too many Mondays in a row where you don't feel like going to work, you're probably in the wrong job. And I loved what I did for a long time. And then it just started, I didn't love it as much, right? I didn't love my job. I didn't love the situation. I didn't love some things about it. And so I realized that wasn't going to change. And I didn't want to be the type of person who just stayed there and overstayed their welcome. And, you know, I didn't want to, I knew I wasn't going to be able to change anything. I didn't want to go to work every day and bang my head against a wall and have no progress. And I didn't want to become cynical and I didn't want to become jaded. So I knew I had to leave. And so I left and I wasn't quite sure. And this relates to confidence a lot, right? I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure how I was going to make a living. I wasn't sure about a lot of things. But my mom showed up at my house. She's crying. She's like, "Why are you throwing away this great job with this good pension? You're throwing your life away. You're making a terrible mistake." And, you know, that was really hard for me because whenever you do something hard in life, there's going to be people in your circle. And sometimes they're going to stay in your circle and sometimes they're going to leave your circle, but there's going to be people in your circle who tell you what you're doing is wrong because it looks different than them. And ultimately, if you want different outcomes than other people, you have to do things that are different than other people. So I thought about it and I said, you know, I really don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm very confident that I can take the next step and I can figure it out. And often what happens when we look at decisions or anything we're trying to accomplish in life, we tend to look very far into the future. I want to be a successful entrepreneur. And so we just in our head, we map out, you know, in 10 years, I want to be rich and famous and whatever success means to you as a person. And the problem with that is it's too big. The gap between where we are and where we want to be is so big. It's like you're starting a marathon, but you're focused on the finish line. Well, there's 26.2 miles or 26.1 miles or whatever it is between you and there. And if the gap is huge between where you are and where you want to go, you don't take action. What happens is paralysis. You don't do anything. And so I call this next step confidence. You just have to figure out what's the next step? What's the most visible short-term thing I can do? That action is going to create confidence. That action is going to create momentum. And that action leads to the next action. What's the first step that I can take? What's the first action that I can do right now that's going to make me move towards the goal that I want to go to? And so that's how I sort of figured it out. I didn't really quite know. And I mean, there's all these stories about people who I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I mean, that's not my journey. I wasn't quite sure. I knew that I needed to make a living and I knew that I needed to find a way to do that. And I was confident in myself to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, I can very much relate to that. I mean, you know, when I started up, I didn't want to do a couple of things. So, you know, so deciding on what not to do is also one of the most interesting things to do, right?
Yeah, definitely, right? And there's a whole bunch of things that you don't want to do or you can't do and what's not to do. And I think, you know, I don't believe in follow your passion purely. I think, you know, what am I interested in and how does that relate to sort of earning a living? Can I figure out an intersection between something I find really fun and easy and something that other people find maybe difficult? Can I add value? What are the things that I really want in life, right? I want to add value to as many people as I can.
Right. And so one of the things that you mentioned, right, the next step, you know, the whole framework, right? You know, so how do you even know that, you know, the next step is going to take me to the big goal? I think that is one of the big challenges that, you know, because if you're
focus on day-to-day goals, right? And you know, you might end up as a, you know, in a complete no-go phase, you know, or you just hit the wall. And you know, so I mean, do you have any suggestions on how to even decide on, you know, what is the right way to approach a problem statement?
Well, you never quite know if the next step is going to take you where you want. That's why small steps are great, right? Because if I am trying to go from New York to LA and I go in the wrong direction, I want to figure out that I'm going in the wrong direction as quickly as possible. And I want to course correct and get back on track. I don't want to take big, giant steps because then I'm going really far in the wrong direction. And those little steps just add momentum and they allow you to sort of, what you're really trying to do is be open to feedback of the world. People aren't always going to tell you the things that you want to hear. A great example of that is like if you work in an organization, I guarantee you right now, your colleagues know that there's one thing holding you back. There's one thing getting in the way of your success. And none of them have ever told you that. So you have to be open to the feedback of the world. And the feedback of the world is going to tell you whether you're on the right track or not if you're open to it. Instead of the world should work this way. That's where so many of us get caught up. We want the world to work a certain way. We're negotiating with how the world actually works. And I really try to be open-minded. And the three words that I use that I have written on my desk here, I sort of have this little sticky note. I don't know if you can read that, but it says outcome over ego. And so that just, I want to keep in mind, I don't have to be right. You know, it's not about me being right. It's about getting the outcome, achieving the objectives that I'm trying to achieve, and making sure, from my point of view, that those objectives are worth achieving. And I think that's something I talk about in the last chapter of Clear Thinking, which is, you know, it's not enough to sort of get what you want. You have to want what's worth getting. And the story that we all know about this is Ebenezer Scrooge. What did Scrooge want? He wanted to become the wealthiest, most well-known, most successful person in his community. And he achieved all of those things. But what did he want to do at the end of his life? He wanted a redo because the way that he went about achieving those things was mutually exclusive from living a life of meaning, from building meaningful relationships with other people, and ultimately achieving the things that he wanted to achieve. So often we just let society tell us what goals we should pursue and what goals we should go after. And that never works.
Awesome. Awesome. And one of the chapters that I really liked in Clear Thinking was in problem solving. You know, first of all, defining the problem statement, right? I think that to me is, I mean, and I come from a very strong product background. And I believe the first principle thinking is missing in a lot of product, you know, people that I talk to, because we often don't define the problem statement, you know, correctly. So would love to know your insights on, you know, first of all, you wrote about AND plus OR way of thinking, right? You know, so if you could elaborate on that.
Well, there's a couple problems, right? So what tends to happen in most organizations that are full of smart people, like the people listening to this, is that you get into a room and you have, you know, 5 to 8 people and you're trying to decide what to do about a problem. And if you haven't agreed on what the problem is, then people will throw out ideas about what the problem is. And the first problem statement that sounds reasonably accurate, all of a sudden everybody wants to solve it. And when you want to solve it, you switch from defining the problem to solving the problem. And the problem with that is most of the time, that problem statement, that initial problem statement, is sort of loosely the problem, but not quite the problem. And when that happens, you're solving the wrong problem. You're spending 80, 90% of your time solving a problem that you should be spending, you know, I would say 50 to 60% of your time defining the problem. The other problem with that is the person who's accountable for making the decision in what really works in the real world is that people are accountable for making decisions. And the person who is responsible for making the decision is also responsible for defining what the problem is. And so what I recommend doing, and we talk about this in the book, is sort of like building a firewall between these two meetings. Instead of having one meeting that's an hour, you have 2 half-hour meetings. But the point of the first meeting is just to gather information about what the problem is. And you don't want to just ask other people what they think the problem is. I mean, that might be a low quality way of going about it, and it might yield results depending on the people in your team. What you really want to do is ask people how they see the situation, what's getting in the way, what would it look like if this problem didn't exist, where's the root of the problem, how do you see this in a way that I don't see it? Because the person who's responsible for making the decision needs to get the most input. They're the ones who tend to have blind spots. They have blind spots into the problem. Maybe they're a higher level in the organization, in which case they're seeing a big strategic view, but they're not seeing down in the weeds. And if they're down in the weeds, they're not seeing a big strategic view. So we all have these blind spots that we need to sort of try to fill in or reduce, right? If you think about decision making, the source of all problems in decision making is that we have blind spots. Blind spots come from perspective. How do we gain perspective? And the best way to do that is to drop our ego and ask how you see the problem. I want to see it like you see it. I want to see it through your language. I want to see it through your eyes. I want to see how it impacts you. I want to see those things. I don't want to judge those things. And this is where it so often gets in the way, which is we insert our judgment here. I don't see it that way. And then we start arguing. But it's not about arguing. It's about show me how you see it. Because ultimately, I'm responsible for making the best decision possible. That means I have to define the problem in a way that is the best way possible to get us closest to the solution. And what happens when you do this in practice, and you know, I put this into place for about 15 years. And what happens when you do that in practice is you end up solving something a lot closer to the actual problem. Often you solve the actual problem, but if not, you solve something much closer to it. So you spend less time in the future correcting these initial mistakes that you make when you just rush to solve the wrong problem. And I think that that's a simple takeaway that everybody can use, everybody can implement. What you're really doing is you're creating an artificial constraint to turn your desired behavior into your default behavior. And the artificial constraint is we're going to have two meetings whenever this happens. So we're creating a rule, and that rule is going to become process. It's going to become ritual, and that's going to carry us through, right? Even if we're rushed, even if we're hurried, even if our emotions are getting the best of us sometimes, it all happens to all of us. How do we get this in a way that we can create a system that sort of takes over when our willpower is lacking?
Very interesting. And this also brings in the perspective that even though you can solve a problem, but doing the second order thinking, right? That, you know, what happens after this, right? What happens after we have solved the problem? And I think that's where a lot of mess also happens, because if people have a short-term goal, right, then it's very difficult to, you know, align them to the long-term goal. You know, it's as simple as saying that if my short-term goal is to just increase the GMV of my e-commerce company, you know, I'll just throw away a lot of discounts. I meet my quarterly goals, but in the long term, you know, the company suffers.
Well, if you blindly work towards a long-term goal, you know, I don't think that that's a great idea either. I think, you know, you get into a couple of problems with what you just talked about. There's sort of like a map territory problem. When you're running only based on numbers, then, you know, what's actually happening in the business, the numbers don't always tell you the full story, and you have to reach down and touch the territory. So if you're running it on a spreadsheet, you can get misled by the numbers that you think are marching towards your goal when actually you're not, right? You're treating your customers poorly. You can't catch that just through numbers, because you can take advantage of your customers in the short term. Long term, that's going to come back to bite you. And so you have to operate. I always operate with, like, where's the destination I want to get to? But what are the indicators that we're getting there? What are the indicators that we're not getting there? What should I look out for? And how do we touch the medium every now and then to make sure we're actually looking at the right metrics, looking at the right indicators? And then those help us guide us to the path. Again, what do we really want to do? We want to get to a place where we course correct quickly if things go wrong. And if we take that approach, we know we want to go from LA or from New York to LA. But really what we're trying to do is, okay, well, how do we know we're walking the right path in this destination? And what would be the signs that we sort of like went one degree in the wrong direction so we can get back to the shortest path possible to our goal?
Very interesting. So Shane, one of the challenges that I see is that, you know, when you learn a new mental model, or, you know, so for example, be it from your book or, you know, from several other places, how do you really go about incorporating this in your regular life, you know, especially when that moment arrives when you have to, when you're supposed to use that mental model or that way of thinking?
Well, it's like everything else, right? You can't show up at the cricket pitch and play the game. You got to practice. You got to do all the reps beforehand. You can't show up and play a football game under the big lights when everybody's watching, when it matters most, if you haven't done all the work before that. You're just going to look like an idiot. You're going to get the wrong answer. You're not going to be better. So when you learn something, you have to apply it and you have to do a couple things to actually learn it. So it starts with what is learning? And if we go back, the process for learning is not simply that we read something. I have an idea called the learning loop, which is that we have an experience, we reflect on that experience. Through that reflection, we create a compression. That compression creates an action. So now you have a loop. And if you think about learning that way, when you read something, the way to integrate that knowledge, the way to really chew it and digest it, to add it to what you already know, is to reflect on the material that you're consuming. And reflection takes time. It takes thinking, it takes writing, it takes sort of concentrated effort to distill this big thing that you learned. Now, an experience, this conversation is an experience. Reading a book is an experience. Me doing something is an experience. Everything is really an experience when you think about it. So the input is the experience. And I need to reflect on it. What can I learn from that? How do I take that learning so that I'm in a different situation next time? You come up with a compression, which is you take these, you know, terabytes of data that are coming in through this experience, through all of your senses, and you compress it into something that encapsulates what you've learned from that. And that compression, Twitter's a great place for this, right? It's good practice, sort of like creating maxims or tweeting out things that are really short. And those are compressions of larger knowledge. Sometimes you go too general and they're useless, but often it's your encoding of something that you've learned and your specific knowledge. And those become really useful for actions next time. And if we just consume other people's abstractions or compressions, so we only consume Twitter, for example, we have the illusion of knowledge. It's like me making a recipe. I can pull out a recipe from a cookbook and I can make that recipe. And if everything goes well, you won't be able to taste the difference between me and a professional chef. But if things don't go well, a professional chef, the person who made the recipe, the person who reflected on it, person who has hundreds of iterations of this, they can taste it and they know, oh, it's overheated. You didn't add enough salt. You didn't stir it the right way. They know instantly what went wrong. And that's the difference between real knowledge and deep fluency and sort of surface level knowledge. And in all areas of life, we can be deep or we can be shallow. We can't be deep in everything. And a lot of us are increasingly just shallow in everything. We have to really pick our spots and our vectors, where we want to go deep, where we want to get knowledge from, how we want to integrate that. And the other way that we can integrate knowledge into what we already know and sort of create a lattice work of ideas, if you will, is that when we're reading, I have a process called the blank sheet. And if you Google the blank sheet, look for the Farnham Street link. And it tells you what I do when I read. So I basically pull out a blank sheet of paper about a book and I write what I know about the book on a mind map, what I know about the subject on a mind map before I even open the book. And then as I'm reading the book, I add to that mind map. I usually use a different color pen so I can see my knowledge building. Sometimes I erase things or like cross them out because I'm like, oh, that's not quite right. The book explains this better. Sometimes the book is using better vocabulary. Sometimes it doesn't really add to it. And if I don't see that it's adding, I know it's probably not worth reading. Sometimes I know nothing. So I literally start with a blank sheet and then I use the author's scaffolding of the idea as the basis for my blank sheet. So that's fascinating because even if I pick up I put down a book after three or four chapters, the next time I pick it up, I just review this blank sheet. I know instantly where I'm at. Now here's where it gets really interesting. At the end of this book, you take that sheet and you can make it clean or whatever. You can clean it up if you want. And then you put it in a binder. And you put it in a binder and you review that binder, say, every 6 months or something. And now all of a sudden you start connecting ideas. The next time you read a book on that subject or that topic, you can review this mind map you already have. And that's going to give you a connection to this next book. So now all of a sudden, you're adding to this foundation you already have. Now, it's a work in progress because sometimes the language is changing. Often authors talk about the same thing, but they use different language. And so your job is to synthesize this knowledge across different domains, but also from different authors talking about the same thing. And when two or three or four authors are really talking about the same thing, often what happens is we gloss over it. But really, those are the strongest points, right? Because those are the points that don't tend to change much. Those are the points that people don't argue about. Those are like the basics, if you think of it. And we're so drawn to complexity, but in reality, the basics makes up most of the outcome.
Yeah, I think if you really look at it, pretty much most of the knowledge wisdom that we are talking about in today's time was probably discussed, 50 years, 100 years back as well. Right. So I mean, the way I look at it is that we are trying to look at complexity in everything, while probably things are a little more simpler.
Yeah. I mean, we're searching for complexity and we're forgetting the basics. But, you know, Kobe Bryant had this great story once that I heard from a friend who knew him. And my friend said, you know, Kobe used to practice the basics more than anybody. He'd be doing the drills that like an 8-year-old would be doing. He would do them every day and he never got bored with them. And I think there's something to that, right? And if you listen to sort of Munger and Buffett and sort of a lot of these people, they're really focused on the basics. They don't really focus on complexities. The complexities, I think they understand better than they let on, but they really bring things back to here are the 3 or 4 variables that govern the situation, and they're almost all basics. And we're going to apply these lenses to that situation and we're going to get some insight. I think there's a natural entropy to people to chase complexity because we feel smarter, we feel more valuable. It's a good talking point. There's a lot of value to teaching complexity. You know, if it was just teaching simplicity, people wouldn't want to pay for it. And so there's a lot mixed up gunk in the world about chasing complexity when in reality, we should be chasing simplicity.
Awesome. Awesome. So one of the things that you actually talk in your book is the easy mode versus hard mode. I would really want you to explain that, especially, you know, given that a lot of people, even though they might have read the book, I think it's easy to, you know, skip that part because it seems very obvious. But implementing that in real life, I think it's a little more tough. So if you could elaborate on that.
I think the best way to explain this is that we tend, I'll give an example after this, but we tend to look at decisions as the point of the decision forward. We tend to look at all of our problems, everything from the point forward. We tend to go to couples therapy and we talk about the argument. We talk about the moment we get into an argument, we talk about forward. We go to work and we talk about, we have a problem. We talk about the moment of the problem forward. And we do the best we can in those moments, given the circumstances, given who we are as people. And what we forget is that there's a lot of things that come before this moment that really dictate what happens in that moment. And if we don't think about what comes before, we're really playing on hard mode. And a great example of that, and for all you parents out there, one of my kids came home, and I'm an honorary Indian parent. So like I have high expectations of my kids and their grades and their work habits, which is reasonably uncommon in sort of North America. But, you know, I expect a lot out of them and they expect a lot out of themselves. And he came home and he got a really, you know, poor grade for him. And he sort of does that teenager thing and he passes me the test because I have to sign it. And he shrugs his shoulders and he like goes by and he's like grunts that he did his best. And I was like, well, I'm not going to talk to him right now because I know his emotions are running high. And I'm going to wait for this to calm down. And then later that night, you know, after things, the dust had settled a bit and he's a lot more comfortable, I said, hey, I really want you to explain what it means to me. You said you did your best. I don't know what that means. I want you to explain it. Walk me through it. And so he's like, you know, I sat down at 10. I read all the questions. I looked at all the points. I allocated my time to the questions worth the most points. And, you know, I double checked my work and I did the best I could. And the test just kicked my butt. And I said, oh, okay. You think about that like most adults think about it, right? Like we get faced with a challenge, an obstacle, and we do our best from that moment forward. And I was like, but hold on, just humor me here. Let's rewind 72 hours. Did you study? Well, not really. Did you go to bed on time? No, not really. Why not? Because I started studying at 10:30 at night. So you started studying 10:30 the night before your test and you stayed up late. So did you, what was your morning like? Like, did you get up on time? No, I got up late. I was running late. And so I got into a fight with my brother because now I'm in the bathroom at the same time as my brother. And I was like, oh, did you eat a healthy breakfast? No. Well, why not? I didn't have time to get a healthy breakfast. So I just grabbed junk. I was like, so you grabbed junk food, you got into a fight with your brother, you didn't sleep, and you barely studied. I was like, it sounds like you're playing on hard mode. And what I mean by that is all of these things we just talked about, they're all within your control. And all of those things position you to be much better when you show up to write that test. Now, the test isn't going to change. But the way you handle that test is dictated by things that come long before that test. And these are things you control. You don't just show up on Sunday and expect to perform under the bright lights. You got to practice all week. You got to do the things within your control to get better, to put yourself in a position. And I developed the language easy mode or hard mode because it's something my kids understand. They love video games. I'm like, do you want to play on hard mode? Do you want to play on easy mode? And we often talk about this, and we'll talk about it on a Saturday, for example, when, you know, they'll have a ton of homework and that homework isn't due Monday. That homework might be due, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I say, okay, how do we position ourselves so this week is on easy mode? What do we have to do today to put ourselves in position so that the week is going to go on easy mode? Because if we don't, we're going to have to stay up cramming. It's going to be on hard mode. And so we use this language, and it's a great way to actually talk to kids and adults about positioning. And I think that we sort of forget how much is within our control. The worst aid, the best aid to judgment I have ever seen is operating from a good position. Everybody looks like an idiot when they're in a bad position. Doesn't matter if you're Warren Buffett. If circumstances are forcing you to make a bad decision, you're making a bad decision. Like, you're not even making a decision. Circumstances are dictating what happened. You never want to be in a situation where circumstances outside of your control are dictating what happens. You always want to be in a position where you're doing what you want to do because you want to do it. And I think, you know, if you think about sort of the debt levels we take on, if you think about whether we're saving money or we're not saving money, these are things, the basics, going back to the basics, these are things that we all know, but we don't always do. And you can think about sleep this way too. And this is a great one for marriage counselors out there or anybody struggling in their relationship. If you get a bad night's sleep and you eat unhealthy and you go home with your partner and, you know, there's a little spark and that spark turns into a fire. Well, if you have slept, it doesn't change the fact that there's going to be a spark, but it's going to change how you respond to that. And I like to think about this as like, how do I position myself in this relationship? How do I position it so we're playing on easy mode? It doesn't change the fact that there's going to be a test, doesn't change the fact that, you know, somebody's going to say something passive aggressive, but how do we put ourselves in a position where that sort of doesn't happen? Well, we can sleep, we can eat well, we can spend time together and connect when we're feeling good. So when things aren't going right, all of a sudden, we handle that better. And my friend, you know, Peter Kaufman has this analogy, and he says, there's a little patch of grass between us. And you think about that. You live in the desert, and there's this patch of grass between you and your partner. And every day that grass dries out because that sun is just beating down on it. And if you water that grass, every day, nothing happens. A little spark, what happens to a spark on wet grass? Nothing. But if you don't water that grass, it dries out. And what does a spark do? It starts a fire. So how do we position ourselves so that, you know, we're just better able to handle these ups and downs and variations of life? Do we want to be on easy mode? Do we want to be on hard mode?
And that goes back to your outcome versus ego, right? Because in relationships, you all always have your egos, and you may or may not so worry about the outcomes.
Yeah. And so what are the things that we just covered, right? So just for takeaways for people listening, you know, sort of think about your debt level, saving money, sleeping, working out, eating well, investing in your relationship, all things within your control. All these things impact how you respond to circumstances and whether circumstances are forcing you to do something you don't want to do or whether you're mastering your own circumstances.
Awesome. Awesome. So Shane, one of the things that you have covered in your books and in general across a lot of your conversations has been on decision-making, right? And I mean, it's probably one of the most difficult things to apply when it comes to mental models or even, you know, how to think about decision-making, right? So I would love to have your insights, your experiences, especially, you know, when things are very fuzzy and you need clear thinking.
Yeah, the minute you sort of need clear thinking the most is when you're least likely to have it. I think what tends to happen is that situations take control of us and we respond without thinking. And in that moment, we're no better than animals. And so we can build things into situations where we are prone to respond without reasoning. A great example of that, I talk about this in the book in terms of the social default. We want to be liked by other people. And what does that mean? Well, that means who hasn't said yes to something that they don't want to say yes to? Somebody calls you, asks you to do something. Maybe you know them, maybe you don't, but you still, okay, whatever, I'll do it. Yeah, it's 3 months out. I won't think about it. And so you end up saying yes to people, even though you don't want to do the thing. And we do that because there's 10,000 years behind this, right? We have to fit in with the tribe a reasonable amount, because if we don't fit in, we get kicked out. And if we get kicked out, that meant death. And so this is like a biological tendency in us. Just like other animals, when we're put in a situation where this gets triggered, we react without reasoning. The difference between humans and animals is that we can reason without reacting. But if we don't, we're no better than the animals. And so how do we overcome a moment like this, for example? Well, you can create an automatic rule. And I got this automatic rule from Daniel Kahneman. And I was in his apartment one day, and you know, he was talking on the phone, and towards the end of the conversation, he said something along the lines of, "My rule is I never say yes on the phone. I'll get back to you tomorrow." And then he hung up. And I said, "Daniel, tell me about this. What is a rule? Like, haven't heard of this." And he said, "You know, I find myself saying yes to things I don't want to say yes to. So I just created this rule. And this rule says this, and now I don't say yes. And before I was saying yes to like 80% of these things, and you know, I wanted to do 10% of them." And he's like, "Now I say yes to 10% of them, and I just do the ones I want to do. So much easier for me to think about it or email them tomorrow and say, you know what, that just doesn't work. I'm sorry. It's so much harder for me to say that on the phone because I don't want to disappoint people. I don't want people disappointed in me, and I want them to like me." And I said, "Daniel, this must be this might be the most powerful thing you've come up with. I know you have a Nobel laureate and you've done all of this amazing work, but like, this is really useful and practical. And what other rules do you have?" And he's like, "None." And I was like, "What? This is crazy." And so this rule, you adopt this rule. And the rule is you never say yes on the phone. You never say yes, you know, within 15 minutes. You come up with whatever that rule is for you in the situations that you're most uncomfortable with or the situations where you tend to do things you don't want to do. And then you apply it. And this transforms everything. You're turning your desired behavior into your default behavior. You're reprogramming your brain so that your default response is your desired response. It doesn't matter if you're tired. It doesn't matter if you're hungry. It doesn't matter. All these things don't matter. Your default response just goes. And so I found that really powerful. And I call them automatic rules for success. And I went and I was like, okay, I'm going to try this. Because, you know, I want to be healthy. I was struggling to work out 3 days a week. I was supposed to go Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Like most people, I mean, I don't like working out. Some people do. I think they're crazy. Like some people just run on that treadmill and they're running like super fast and, you know, there's no sweat on their face. I'm the opposite of that. I'm like running slow and like there's sweat everywhere and I feel like I shouldn't have ate that thing last night and I'm like beating myself up. But I would get up and, you know, I was supposed to go to the gym today and then I'd be like, oh, I got a lot of work to do. I got a lot of meetings. I don't feel like going. And I would start negotiating with myself. And by negotiating with myself, what happened was I would just convince myself, I'll do more tomorrow. So I wouldn't go. And then I went to the gym and I said, hey, how many times have I been here in the last 365 days? Go back a year and just tell me the number of visits I've had. And they told me the number of visits and it was like 1.4 a week or something. I was like, oh God, I'm going half the time I'm supposed to. So from that day forward, I said, you know what? I'm going to have a rule. My rule is that I work out every day. And since then, I think I've missed 2 days, 3 days, maybe. And this is years. And you think that that sounds hard. It's actually so much easier to have a rule where you exercise every day. Because what happens is I'm not negotiating with myself over whether I'm going to do it. Now it's like, how do I fit it in? Now, I'm not trying to fit in 60 or 90 minutes every day. So your duration or scope can change. But the fact that I exercise every day never changes. And I think that that's just a powerful way to accomplish your goals when you think about it. So some other sort of automatic rules that I use personally is, you know, I invest in an index fund every month. I stop drinking at 9 o'clock usually, even when I'm out with friends. Nothing good happens after 9 when you're over 40. You know, I don't have meetings until 12, right? So I don't take meetings with people until 12 o'clock on. Why? Because the first part of my day is for me. And that's my rule. And there's very, very few exceptions to that, where I want my most creative, my most energetic time to be devoted to most important opportunities in front of me. And those opportunities aren't always work related. Some days I just walk my kids to school, and you know, some days I sleep in, and it's not all about being productive. It's just a matter of, I never have to find time to work on the things that are important to me. It's already built into my calendar. And a lot of people are probably saying, well, I work at an organization, I can't do that. Well, I implemented this starting when I worked at an organization. What I did was I looked at my calendar and I was like, oh my God, I'm so busy. How am I ever going to find time for me? And then I just went out and I went out and I went out. I think it was like 6 months, and I was like, ah, every Tuesday morning I have, you know, 60 minutes. And then I would make an invite with myself and I blocked that off so nobody else would see what was going on and they couldn't book it. And then I would find a Wednesday. And then sooner, you know, I think it took about a year and I got to the fact where I basically had no mornings or no meetings any morning until 10 a.m. And that was really powerful for getting stuff done at work. Those were the most productive time. I mean, most people are most productive at work before people get there or after people leave. And I found that a really powerful way to get things done when people were there.
Awesome. Awesome. And, you know, talking about your day-to-day work, right? So how do you come up with ideas around what are you going to write? What are you reading? You know, whom are you interviewing? So do you have a team which does the research, or is it just you who's looking around, looking at, you know, what's interesting out there? So what's your process?
I wish I had a great answer for this for people. It's just me following my curiosity. That's it. Like, so when we talk about reflecting as a key to learning, that the website fs.blog is my reflections. The newsletter is sort of like what I'm reading and thinking about this week and what I'm learning effectively. I'm sharing what I'm learning with you, the reader. And then the podcast is me sort of, oh, I want to talk to this person because I'm curious about a particular thing. And so it's really great that I'm allowed to follow my curiosity for a living and sort of explore that. And really great that I get to share that with everybody else. But I wish it was more complicated. I wish there was like a big team of like 20 people behind the scenes. We're doing like AI research and we're trying to figure out the best questions to ask. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's just me. I do a lot of research for each episode. I don't want to waste the guest time. I don't want to waste the listener's time. And I definitely don't want to waste my time. And so I sort of ask questions that people don't normally ask, and I want to make it useful and practical for people, but I also want to sort of uncover the knowledge, the maximum amount of knowledge I can in the time I have with the guest.
Yeah, I think, you know, Anderson Horowitz, I think they came up with this interesting metric called insights per minute. Mm-hmm. And I've really followed that, you know, in all the conversations that, you know, if it's not adding value, you know, just don't do it. So yeah, talking about AI, right? So how do you think it's going to change the world? I mean, you know, especially this, you know, will it make people more curious, given that the answers in everything is, you know, a few chats away, a few prompts away, right? So do you think this is going to make people less curious, more curious? What do you think is going to happen the next, you know, couple of months and years?
I think there's always going to be a market for insight. And I think that the best people are always going to be more insightful than pure AI at certain things. I do think that there's going to be a new baseline for the quality and competence that you need to deliver from a work perspective. And you need to outpace that baseline because that baseline is now increasing rapidly and quickly. On the other hand, I see how my kids use it. And I'm just like in awe of this. And I think they use it to study. They have this teacher available 24/7 who's endlessly patient, who never gets upset with them, never loses their voice with them, never loses their composure with them, can explain things in 10 different ways to them. And I see how they learn it to augment their learning. And the best version of AI is sort of, hey, you know, talk to me. What did my youngest do the other day? Talk to me about Animal Farm. You know, what are the key passages? What are the character sketches? What are the moments? How do I relate that to Stalin and what was going on at the time? And I think that those insights are sort of amazing. and the way that they interact, and they read the book, and then they sort of like have these questions, and you know, they don't always feel comfortable asking them to their teacher in class, and now they can just ask ChatGPT. And that doesn't mean ChatGPT is right or whatever AI is right. And that by the time, you know, in the next 3 or 4 years, I think we'll just be on this whole right, wrong thing. I think that's a fascinating way for them to learn. Think of math, right? You're having a particular problem in math, it can diagnose exactly what it is, teach that yep. to you and move you on. And so I think teachers, the worst teachers have a lot to fear from AI. One of the risks with that is that kids don't write anymore. And I think that that's a big risk because I think writing is one of the ways that we learn about thinking. And so there's sort of like this little war going on, cold war between teachers and students. And I think, you know, I don't want my kids ever using it to write an essay for them. That's not how we use it. And we've used it in the past to get feedback on our essays after we've submitted them to school. They've used them to sort of find spelling and grammar corrections and stuff like that. I think that that's a great use of that for kids. And I think that that's sort of like age appropriate. I think generating an essay on the Civil War that's a certain number of words, you know, I think that that's just baloney. It's not serving the kids. It's not serving the teachers. It's not serving anybody. Nobody wins in that situation. And so I see how easily my kids use AI, and I'm optimistic about the future. I'm optimistic about AI solving a lot of problems, but it's also going to create a lot of problems. And I think we're just sort of at the cusp of both. It's starting to solve problems that humans haven't been able to solve. I think it's solved a couple of math problems as of now that we've never been able to solve. And I think that, you know, that will be remembered as sort of the first step on the moon, where it solved a problem that we couldn't solve. And it's going to create all these other problems. And I think generally technology is a net positive. And I think that we need to embrace the changes that are coming and embrace AI. And, you know, my kids are using AI daily. And, you know, a long time ago, people didn't think that Google's moat could be challenged. And yep. You know, my kids barely use Google anymore. They use ChatGPT or Perplexity as their default search engine. Great. And I think that there's a, you know, there's a lot of things that are going to change, but I'm generally really optimistic and positive about the trajectory of technology. And I'm excited to see what we can do with sort of cancer and diagnosis and health. And I'm excited to see what we can do with climate change. And I'm excited to see what we can do with so many things that are so perplexing to us. Can we design a better car? Can we design better batteries? Can we be better global citizens as a result of this? And yes, there's always going to be people that abuse this, and it's going to change a lot of things. And it comes with a lot of drawbacks, but the possibility for progress is amazing and inspiring.
Yep. And talking about kids, right? So what are some of the skills that you think are really going to be important going forward? You know, I mean, I also have teens, you know, two teens. So I'm looking at how they use ChatGPT, how they use AI, and how they compare that with their teachers. And they think, yeah, I mean, ChatGPT is much better when it comes to explaining a few things as opposed to their teachers, right? But
well, hopefully that forces teachers to get better. Exactly. And yeah. That'll be great, right? So it's just like it's going to force workers to be better, to be more productive in some ways, but more insightful. And the baseline of work is going to change. I think, you know, for everybody, it's going to force us maybe, optimistically out of our complacency. Where we think we know it's right and we think we've got this nailed. And if you have a problem with what we're doing, then you're the problem. And I think hopefully it takes us out of that. But what I try to teach my kids is the skills that aren't going to change because of AI. You know, your ability to think is still going to be incredibly important. So how do we make sure you're thinking and AI is not thinking for you? Your ability to handle setbacks is going to be critical. So the question to ask is, what's not going to change because of AI? Your ability to work with people is still Yep. going to be a critical feature. There's a lot of things that are still going to apply, and we get lost in this world of everything's going to change. There's no point in teaching kids. And I mean, I've heard some crazy stories from teachers and educators about all of this stuff. And I think optimistically, there's a lot of things that aren't going to change. We just have to orient ourselves around those things and focus on those. Build resilience in kids, teach them how to think. I mean, get back to the basics of education, if you think about it.
Yep, Exactly. I mean, the way I look at it is that, you know, the so-called soft skills, you know, I mean, the world called them soft skills because there was no, I mean, the actual words were the life skills, right? But I don't know why industry preferred to call them soft skills. And they are soon going to become the life skills, you know, because the ability to observe, talk to people, understand, I think that's going to be super critical.
What you want to do is you want to alloy different skills together, and so that those skills can't be replicated by AI as easily. If you're just following the instructions of AI, you know, we fast forward 5 years, that's like working at McDonald's equivalent, right? It's put the fries down for this long, pull them up when the buzzer goes off, and you know, you listen to the AI. If you don't know when to opt out of AI judgment, when AI judgment might be wrong, I mean, that's going to be a valuable skill. How do we combine AI and human judgment in the same? And your most productive workers are going to be 10 to 100 times more productive than they are now, which means they're going to be 10 to 100 times more productive than the worst productive person, because they're going to have better tools available to them. And they're going to better utilize those tools in a way that they can leverage, and your best employee can leverage in one way and your worst employee can leverage in a different way. And I think that that is going to create a huge disparity between contributions at work. But I'm optimistic that if we don't take the ceiling off the best people and we raise the floor for the worst people and everybody sort of prospers in the process, that we can achieve our goals. The thing that would scare me the most is if we try to put a ceiling on our best people at the same time as trying to put a floor on our worst people. And I think that that solution scares me the most for humanity, because it's the best people that are going to get us out of our problems.
Yep. So Shane, couple of last sort of questions.
Sure.
How do you collect feedback? How do you gather feedback, you know, of all the stuff you're doing at personal and professional level?
Well, we talked about this before, right? I'm just open to the world. And, you know, I ask myself on a regular basis, am I getting what I want? Is what I want worth getting? And if I'm not getting the results that I want, I keep doing the same thing. You know, I'm probably thinking that the world should work in a way that it doesn't work. And I need to change course or not do that thing. You know, I think investing is one of those things where, you know, I've sort of switched to index funds over the last few years, and I'm gradually doing more and more of that. And is that the right answer? I don't know. But when I looked at my investing results and, you know, the time that I was spending on investing, and you know, I was getting slightly better results than I would have gotten had I been in an index fund, but it was consuming a lot of time, and there was a lot more risk involved in it and a lot more uncertainty in my ability to continue to do that. And so now what I do is this sort of like, oh, I'll invest in index funds, and if I find something that's incredibly cheap, I'll just invest in that individual equity. But my default changed to index funds instead of just looking for something else. And I think that's a great example of like listening to feedback of the world, right? Am I getting the results I want? What results would have to justify the amount of time that I'm putting into this? And I think the world sort of tells us what's going on, and in good ways and negative ways, right? And I think we just have to be open to that and interpreting it in the right way. I mean, if you're doing something different than your friends, you're going to get feedback in one way, but that doesn't mean that feedback is right. And so that also needs to shape how you think about things. I think the ultimate question is, am I getting the results I want? If not, why not? Because ultimately, you are the CEO of your own life.
Great. So it's a couple of people, I mean, asked a couple of friends and folks and on questions for you. Some of the questions that came to me were, what is something that you believe in that most people will not agree to? This is the standard Peter Thiel question. So
I don't agree with generational wealth. So I don't think you should be able to pass down, well, like a large enough sum of money to your kids that they can do nothing. So I don't believe in multi-generational sort of inheritance. I think that, you know, if I could take over the world for a day, you know, one thing that I would love for equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome, but equality of opportunity, is to limit the amount of wealth that can transfer from parents to kids, to try to get every generation to basically start fresh and have to make it on their own. And they get all the advantages already of technology and progress and all of these things. And so I would like to do that. But there's no easy or practical way to do it. But I don't believe in sort of giving your kids hundreds of millions of dollars. Or I don't think that's good for society. I don't think it's good for them.
Well, I shared the same with my kid, and he shared a meme, which was basically that this is what you were working for, to give your kid a comfortable life. And now you're saying you won't.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Because at a household level, we're all sort of socialists. And yeah, at a different level, we're maybe liberal. And at a different level, we're sort of conservative. And we're all of these things combined. And I think, you know, from an individual perspective, it might make sense. But from a society perspective, maybe it doesn't make sense. I don't know. That's just something I disagree with that seems to get people riled up quite a bit.
Yep. Next one, what mental model which was useful once, but it doesn't make sense anymore?
Oh, I don't know. They tend to be the niche ones. I tend to focus most of my time on things that don't expire. You know, I've spent 5 years writing a series of books called The Great Mental Models on the big ideas that you learn from the big disciplines. And I'm really trying to nail down the ones, maybe we're wrong with a couple of them, but I'm really trying to nail the ones that don't change and focus on those and focus on applying my effort and energy into those things. But everything is really a mental model. When you think of a mental model, it's just a representation of how something works in your head. And you have them for very niche things and you have them for very general things. And I've just spent most of my time on the general stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Last couple of questions. What's one song that you end up listening to during your work music, if at all you do?
One song. I listen to a lot of old school rap. So like Tupac, Biggie, Eminem, Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre. I'm like a huge old school rap fan.
Awesome.
Dr. Dre's album Chronic plays on repeat often when I'm writing.
Great. That's interesting. A book that you would recommend
for everybody? I mean, am I allowed to recommend my book?
No.
I would recommend Poor Charlie's Almanac, I think, for everybody. I think there's a lot of the wit and wisdom of Charlie Munger, the late Charlie Munger, who I was so fortunate enough to get to know. I would love for more people to learn about his approach to life. I mean, we study him from a business perspective, but he had so much wisdom about living a meaningful and thoughtful life. And I think Peter Kaufman put together an amazing book, and I hope more people read that.
Awesome. Last one, a web series that you really enjoyed and, you know, you would really want others to see.
What?
Web series.
Oh, like a TV series?
Yeah, like the Netflix series.
Oh, gosh, I don't watch much TV.
Oh, you don't?
No. I mean, I do occasionally, but nothing I would recommend to people. You know, I watch some stuff for comic value, like The Real Housewives of Dubai or something. You know, flip on that show for a minute and be like, oh, my God, this is, you know, I try to teach my kids about inversion by watching this. So here's what you don't want. But no, I don't watch anything on a regular basis at all, unless I'm watching it with them. We're currently watching The Mandalorian.
Okay, cool. That's pretty much, Shane. It was really awesome to have you. And again, thanks for your time.